to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. This is Writers' Voices with Monica Hadley. And if you're listening on Friday, it's a beautiful, sunny, late October, almost Halloween here in Iowa. And if you're listening to Monday morning, I hope the weather's just as beautiful. Or if you're listening online at writersvoices.com or KRUUFM.com, you might be listening anytime. But this is Writers' Voices, and this is where we talk to writers, publishers, editors, agents about the process of writing and about the product of writing. Our guest today is a former Fairfielder. He lived here for 17 years. Left in 1999, Michael Cudahy is the managing member of Seven Trust Global Advisors, LLC, a commodity trading advisor, and publisher of Risk and Opportunity, a quarterly economic and political newsletter. He has previously been active in third-party politics and a candidate for U.S. representative. He lives now in Denver, Colorado. Welcome to KRUU and welcome to Writers' Voices, Michael.
Thank you.
So how long has it been since you've been to Fairfield?
Well, actually, I was just recently there. About 2 weeks ago, I was there for 4 or 5 days. I had a little business to do, and it was really quite an enjoyable trip.
Have things changed much here since you left?
A lot, yes. Mm-hmm. It's really, the community is really quite vibrant. There's just a lot going on, a lot of new restaurants and new people, and a lot of old friends too. So it was really quite a pleasant visit.
Well, we're very proud of the community and what's happened here over the last few years, and the growth of the artistic and musical and theatrical community, among other things, and business community too. We're really pretty fortunate. We have a fairly strong economy in Iowa in general and in Fairfield specifically, so we feel pretty lucky that way, pretty blessed.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your book, Chronicle of Catastrophe, A Contemporaneous History of the Bush Years. What brought this book about?
Well, last year, during the so-called healthcare debate, which was really a rather obscene process, I realized that the Republican propaganda was really being successful in obscuring their record, and that people were being misled about what was being done, and really the whole chaotic atmosphere that was being created was completely obscuring any kind of discussion about substantive events, and particularly about how we came to be in this difficult economic environment. So I realized that I had an actual record that had been created real time from the years 2002 through 2008 that could be helpful to people in gaining perspective. So that's when the idea for the book first appeared, and I had been writing my quarterly newsletters starting in 2002, and those were written with the idea of assessing the current environment and giving perspective to people in terms of markets and economy, and also politics and geopolitics, and trying to integrate all of that into a clear picture of what was happening, what the real issues were, and how things were unfolding, and what that might hold for the future. So I felt this could be a valuable resource, and so I undertook to publish the book.
So, Michael, let's back up to the newsletter. So you said you started publishing that in 2002, And was this part of your role as a commodity trading advisor that you were publishing this?
Well, it was somewhat related because, you know, I sit in front of the screen all day every day, and part of what I do is I absorb information from a wide variety of sources, and that's just part of what I do to try to assess markets, and also that takes into account what's going on in Washington and politically, you know, around the country and around the world. So the thing that got me really started, though, was in 2000, when George Bush was elected, I didn't think he was a very good, well-qualified person to be president, but I did feel that at least now we have an all-Republican government, we'll have fiscal responsibility, if nothing else. And I was quite shocked when, right out of the gate, the Bush regime began, along with all Republican Congress, began just completely
eliminating the surpluses that had come out of the Clinton years.
Yeah. Bill Clinton handed the Republicans an opportunity to put our fiscal house in order for generations, and they had this notion of a permanent Republican majority, and they felt like they could just spend whatever they thought on any kind of Republican agenda in order to more solidify their position, and they just completely ignored any notion of fiscal responsibility. I was really shocked, and I didn't see anything in the press about this. And I thought, well, if I start writing something about this, maybe people will take notice, and it'll become an issue. And that was kind of naive, I guess, but I got into the process of writing about it, and I found the writing was helpful to me in maintaining perspective, and I collected a small group of readers who thought that it was an excellent resource for them, so I just continued to do it, and I continue to write it. I actually just published my most recent third quarter newsletter today, the election issue, The Rise of the Mob.
And if someone's interested in actually seeing your current newsletter, where would they find that?
That's at riskopportunity.com.
Okay. And so you publish online?
Yes.
And do you also publish do you mail the newsletter to people or email it to subscribers, or how does that work?
Oh, it's strictly online.
Okay.
And it's a free newsletter. I've never charged for it, so so it's pretty easy for people to get if they're interested.
Now, anyone could, and nowadays it seems like anyone does write economic and political commentary without actually necessarily having much in the way of credentials or a reason for people to believe what they're writing or to believe their analysis, and yet it seems like the more extreme and the more ridiculous some of these analyses are, the more followers they get. So I have two questions. One is, you know, what are your credentials that give that, you know, why should a reader listen or read what you're saying and take it seriously? And two, how do you set yourself apart from all the noise out there?
Well, with regard to the first question, I've been an analyst, trader, fund manager for over 30 years. So I do have a lot of real world, real practical experience with markets and economy, I'm naturally very practically oriented in this regard. I don't have a some kind of ideology that I'm trying to make the world fit into. I'm trying to assess everything that I see to paint a picture of reality, what's really happening, not what I think should be happening. So I think that this has in itself has some value, and especially in a world when so many people are trying to sell their agenda, and sometimes the more divorced from reality that agenda is, the louder and more persistent they are about trying to sell it. So
yeah.
I think that what I do write has value in that regard, and I certainly can't claim omniscience or perfection in my views, but I do really strive to present a picture of what's really happening, and I that was actually the main reason why I thought that the book would have real value for people, because there's so much confusion in the public arena these days, and it's by design. You know, a lot of propaganda and misinformation, and a lot of people promoting themselves through taking extreme positions. It's very confusing and hard for people to gain a clear perspective on what's happening. So I think my newsletter does provide a service in that regard. And the book is a reflection and consolidation of that for this period of time during the Bush years. As far as differentiating myself, I think, you know, the reasonable, rational voice definitely is marginalized in this environment. And
yeah.
I have not found it easy trying to gain any attention. So I'm hopeful that, you know, over time, quality will win out, and I'll just keep plugging. But I'm quite disappointed in the way things have transpired during this election season. I think the lunatics have really gained a lot of traction, and really it's been very damaging to our country. So hopefully, you know, my objective is to provide context and a perspective on what's really happening, and so I'll just keep plugging, and hopefully I'll gain some traction here.
Well, I think you're right that the reasonable, rational voice does. It is hard to get that heard in the short term, but in the long run, I think that there's always a. I don't know. I guess I believe in long-term progress, and that, like, when you look back at different times in history, there was the same kind of noise going on, the same kind of extremism, lunacy, so forth. For example, during Abe Lincoln's time, he was criticized so severely, and very, very harshly and cruelly even. And yet now we see him as the greatest statesman of American history. So I do believe that we are always making little tiny steps towards, dare I say, a more enlightened government.
But well, that's an encouraging perspective, and it's something that I'm trying to contribute to, and I certainly hope that you're right.
I hope so, too. Now, Michael, you talked about when the Republicans took over in the early 2000s, where they did not exercise fiscal restraint and fiscal responsibility, and yet, and I have seen statistics that show that whenever over the past 50 years, it's been the case that the size of government, the spending has grown under Republican rule, and it's actually and the deficits are larger and they're actually smaller under Democratic rule. And yet, I bet 9 out of 10 people that you would talk to think it's the opposite.
And it's a remarkable achievement of modern propaganda. I'm always amazed at how Republicans continue to get away with promoting themselves as the party of fiscal responsibility.
I mean, they're running on that again.
Yeah, yeah. and even as in the same breath, they're promoting the same exact policies that created the fiscal blowout and the economic catastrophe that we're living with. It's just shocking to me. And I think that, you know, I guess you can trace this back, that their success at this really back to our corporate-owned media, which, you know, they don't challenge them about on this.
Right. Well,
so
that's because they benefit from it to a large extent.
I mean, the corporations that own the media now do benefit from it, so they, you know, they probably in their ways make it clear that they don't want this kind of thing being focused on. And I mean, you do have people out there who you know, good people who try and draw attention to this, but they're pretty much ignored by the mainstream media. So I think it is remarkable. I think I mentioned at one point in the book how the old Soviet commissars would really marvel at the power and the efficiency of the modern propaganda machine that the Republicans have built. It's quite impressive in an evil kind of way. I guess I've become I may come across sometimes in conversation as a partisan, but I'm really pretty much down the middle, independent, and I always have been. But I've been really, really distressed at what I've seen coming out of the Republican Party in recent years.
Yeah, well, you're not the only one, and it's hard because I think a lot of people are still loyal to the concept of the Republican Party that that was true, like when I was a little kid, or you know, my father was very much Republican. He was the chair of the county Republican Party here in Jefferson County. Was close to Jim Leach, and whom I have a great deal of respect for, former Congressman Jim Leach. But and they aren't able to see that the policies that are being promoted now are not consistent with those beliefs. I mean, the Republican, that was the party of Lincoln, you know, but it's come a long way from that.
Well, right, and the Republican Party was the original environmental party.
I know.
It's just shocking the way some of the traditional Republican policies have been stood on their head, and yet people do continue to persist in the notion that it's the old party. I mean, Jim Leach is actually one of my very favorite politicians. He was my opponent when I ran for Congress in Iowa, and I got to know him and have the tremendous respect for him. Actually, in my current issue of Risk and Opportunity newsletter, I have a link in there to the National Endowment of the Humanities site, where there are a number of speeches that he has given recently emphasizing the importance of civility in public discourse and bringing attention to the historical consequences of the kind of incivility that we're seeing in our politics today. It can lead to very quickly to some very extreme consequences. So, Jim Leach is a great example of the traditional Republican that is not really welcome in the party anymore.
Yeah, unfortunately, he's a great example of a voice of reason that has been marginalized.
Yes, exactly.
So, this is Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Michael Cudahy, author of Chronicle of Catastrophe, A Contemporaneous History of the Bush Years. Now, Michael, this book is structured as a series of essays which were published on your website beginning with quarter one, 2002. When you went to put them into book form, did you have to do much revising?
No, actually I did almost none. There was, I reread everything, I put a lot of effort into the editing process when I write the letters, and I've been blessed in that my wife is an excellent and very strict editor, and she, Jane, and she has been very helpful in helping me to turn out a product that I think is pretty good quality. And I found that when I reread them, I felt that they had value as they were. They were written at each quarter during this period of time, reflecting the events and circumstances of that time, and I didn't want to alter that. And so I left them almost entirely as they were, with the exception really of one sentence that I thought was not quite right that I cut, and otherwise everything is the same as it was.
Now, I did notice occasionally you made some references to studies or articles or books that are written subsequent to when these were originally published. So I assume you had to have inserted some of those.
What that might be is when we were doing the final, the editing process didn't alter the text at all, but I had to go through, because I have a lot of references in my newsletter, a lot of links to articles and publications and data that back up certain points that I might be making or give additional information. And so I had to, this was one of the major tasks that I had in publishing, was that I had to go back through and refresh those links. Some of them were not good or had changed, and so the editor that I worked with told me that I should use the date that I last accessed them during the
okay, so they were actually they were references that you had at the time you wrote the article, but you updated them.
Okay. They're all most of them are sites or links that people can access in that way. So I wanted to, when I published, I wanted to give the most current address.
Now, there's some of the early ones you are making predictions in some cases about what was going to happen to the economy, the stock market, so forth. How accurate did those predictions turn out to be?
Well, they turned out to be remarkably prescient. That was one of the things that really amazed me when I reread the letters. Once I publish a newsletter, I don't reread it. I've already read it 100 times and during the editing process, and once it's up, then I don't look at it again. And when I reread them in preparation for publishing, I was kind of amazed at how prescient a lot of the predictions were. The timing was a little bit off in some cases. For example, I had some information about the presidential cycle as something that a lot of investors will follow, in which case the market typically will rally into the presidential election, and then it will correct in the 2 years afterwards. And the presidential cycle just totally collapsed in 2008, going into the election, which was very unusual. But otherwise, my predictions were pretty good. I started writing early, and actually a couple of years early in 2002, about the housing situation, and that this was not a healthy market, and that it was going to end badly. And the bubble went on for a couple more years, and it actually finally topped out in the middle of 2005. But I started writing about that in 2002. I also predicted that we were eventually going to see trillion-dollar deficits, which at the time I thought was a rather bold and prediction, that I was really kind of out there on the edge with that. But we certainly have seen that. I did encourage people that I thought that the best position at the end of 2007 for them was to be in cash, which turned out to be a rather good recommendation. And of course, I've been recommending gold to people all along, but I was pretty amazed, and I think, you know, that was kind of a pleasant surprise for me to reread that and see how well those things worked out.
That's good. That's good, because it would have been maybe harder to publish if it had been the other way.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. Well, Michael, would you like to read part of the introduction of this book?
Sure. Yeah, I picked out a couple of things that I thought were maybe key points. What I tried to do in publishing the newsletter was provide a clear picture of what was actually happening, and I do assess a lot of different things, from all perspectives to try and get a clear picture, and I saw. In rereading the newsletters, how really got a real clear contextual picture of the whole period, and how much damage had been done. So I thought, you know, I had a couple of things. One was at the end of the last part of the introduction, just sums it up, and then I thought the beginning of my favorite chapter, which is chapter 14, The Great Debate, which is a review of two books that take a different perspective on the debt bubble.
Okay, so this is Michael Cudahy reading from Chronicle of Catastrophe, A Contemporaneous History of the Bush Years.
So from the introduction, the last few paragraphs, I quote Boris Johnson, the mayor of London. The Bush's legacy was best summed up by London's mayor, Boris Johnson. Quote, however well-intentioned it was, the catastrophic and unpopular intervention in Iraq has served in some parts of the world to discredit the very idea of Western democracy. The recent collapse of the banking system and the humiliating resort to semi-socialist solutions has done a great deal to discredit, in some people's eyes, the idea of free market capitalism. Democracy and capitalism are the two great pillars of the American idea. To have rocked one of those pillars may be regarded as a misfortune. To have damaged the reputation of both, at home and abroad, is a pretty stunning achievement for an American president. End quote. My comment, the era of Republican rule has truly been catastrophic for America. The full cost is yet to be tallied and will probably not be known for at least a decade. Paul Craig Roberts, a genuine conservative, a former assistant secretary of the Treasury during Ronald Reagan's first term, and former associate editor at the Wall Street Journal and the National Review, labels this era the mother of all messes. Public memory, though, is short. It's my hope that this volume, as a readable contemporaneous record of the Bush years, will help readers place our current troubles in context and will contribute to the understanding of how we arrived at this predicament, so citizens can better choose their leaders and future decision makers can avoid the mistakes of the Bush years. So that's the last part of the introduction. And I also thought I would like to read the beginning of my favorite chapter, chapter 14, which is a review of two books. One is The Empire of Debt, truly a book of wisdom, and anybody interested in markets and politics, I would strongly recommend it. And another book called Our Brave New World. These two books take an opposite side of the debate on the debt and the credit bubble that was peaking at this time. This was written in the fourth quarter of 2005. So the first part of chapter 14. The great debate ongoing in financial circles is this. On the one hand, we have the traditionalists, the real conservatives, not to be confused with Republicans, libertarians, and those who generally think that virtue is a desirable pursuit, who say that we have been living beyond our means for far too long, that a debt incurred must and will be paid one way or another, and that we are sooner or later going to have a day of reckoning. The basic position here is that if you create a debt, you must take responsibility for that debt, that our fiscal and monetary policies have been wildly irresponsible, if not downright fraudulent, that the mountain of debt we have created is unsustainable, and that it will inevitably cause us great pain, and that we are impoverishing our children and grandchildren in our live for today or orgy of consumption. This is a pretty simple, straightforward, common-sense position. That is its strength, but in the age of spin, that is also its weakness. On the other hand, we have the market cheerleaders and government officials and an army of paid publicists and pundits who claim that this time is different, that deficits don't matter, that we can continue to run up the debt with no horizon in sight, and that we are doing the rest of the countries of the world a favor by borrowing their savings in order to consume their products so they can keep growing their economies. The debt, we are told, will be worked off by growth and unofficially by devaluation of the dollar. And this will work because we are more intelligent, creative, and industrious than the rest of the world, and also conveniently because our dollar is the world's reserve currency, and everyone has to have dollars, so the world will continue to buy them, like it or not. The economic and moral consequences of the fact that we are creating a mountain of debt that we have no intention of repaying are ignored. This position is complex, consisting mainly of clever arguments that in the end amount to this time is different, and we can have our free lunch and eat it too. So that's the introduction to the review of Empire of Debt and Brave New World, which is my favorite chapter. And so
Michael, what are some other books that influenced you besides these two?
Well, I included a number of different publications, essays, really, from in the book. There were mostly essays that I drew from, I would say, John Malden's publication, his weekly newsletters, Frontline, From the Frontline, were very, very helpful to me. Thoughts from the Frontline is John Malden's. And then I included, in Chapter 11, I included a speech by Paul Volcker, who is one of my heroes in the current political universe. And I just actually did a blog post recently, Paul Volcker, the only honest man in Washington, and he he gave a speech in 2005 at the Stanford Institute of Economic Policy Research, which I included in Chapter 11. In Chapter 12, I included an analysis by an article by William Grider, who is a writer at the journalist at the Nation, called America's Truth Deficit, which is also another one of my favorite chapters. Chapter 15 is an article by Gary Wills, who is a popular author, entitled Christ Among the Partisan, which addresses misguided efforts to politicize religion. There was a move afoot at the time by the people on the left to try and counter the claims of the right wing to be representative of the teachings of Christ in politics, and this article took issue with both of those efforts. And Chapter 7 with Keith Olbermann's, Chapter 17, Keith Olbermann's commentary related to the Military Commissions Act called Your Words Are Lies, Sir, which Keith has a tendency to become a little
strong in his views sometimes.
A little beyond the pale sometimes.
Yeah, a little beyond the pale.
This particular commentary was really right on the money. I thought the Military Commissions Act was really an egregious violation of our values and our traditions, and I still feel that way, and I thought that that his commentary was excellent in this regard. So I also have a speech in here by Martin Luther King, his famous Riverside Church speech on the Vietnam War that I thought was very relevant to the impending war in Iraq. Another popular author, Steven Pinker, a professor at Harvard, wrote a fascinating article called The History of Violence that I included in Chapter 21, which reminds us how dramatically the quality of life for humans has improved over the centuries, you know, despite all the chaos and negativity that we're treated to daily from our media. If you take the long view, we have dramatically improved lives over our ancestors, and actually human beings today, with the exception of a few hotspots in the world, are the least likely to die from violence at any time in history. So it's nice to have something positive to put in and something positive to focus on.
I agree with that, and I think that there's a lot of other ways in which the world is a better place now than it's ever been. Certainly a better place, in my opinion, for women in the West, at least, than most of the world was for women in most of human history. Some of the issues that are so, staring us in the face right now and so divisive are issues that were just swept under the rug and not even looked at in the past, but if they affected you, they were horrible, and you couldn't even talk about them. Mm. I'm thinking about things like gay rights and racism and so forth. And so that's why I believe that we are making progress. These issues are coming out into the light, and eventually, and I do believe that most people at heart are good and will see what's right.
Well, I think that I agree that when you really step back and take the long view, that things really are much better. We've made tremendous progress as in terms of civilization and providing opportunity for human beings to really manifest their full potential, and I think that hopefully this will continue. I think right now we are in the short term in a period where those reactionary forces are resurgent right now, and I think that it's important to address you know, what they stand for and the kinds of things that they're trying to do, and really trying to roll back a lot of this progress.
Oh, absolutely. And the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. And
yes.
I believe that's where we are right now, that we have to be vigilant against losing these freedoms that were very hard won. I received a photo essay recently about the struggle of women to get the right to vote. This was not that long ago. We're talking less than 100 years ago, where women were tortured because they had the audacity to think they should be able to vote. You know, it's incredible. And if you think that it's not possible to go backwards, take a look at the Taliban.
Yes, yeah, they really, really are a very ugly phenomenon, and I think
Marcos Melitsanis, I think. I need to learn that because he's going to be our guest in 2 weeks here on Writers' Voices.
Oh, okay, so. Well, it's a tough last name, so we just think of him as Koss from Daily Koss.
Right.
But, you know, his new book, American Taliban, I think is well titled. And, you know, we do have some pretty nasty people that present themselves oftentimes as Christians, which is another outrageous success of modern propaganda. These people are, you know, they think of themselves as Christians, but they certainly the kinds of values that they hold and the judgment and activities that they take in the public arena or anything, they certainly don't reflect the teachings of the master. So I think you know, this is another issue that really needs more attention in our public debate.
Absolutely. And there's a major attack right now on the concept of separation of church and state.
Right.
People are saying, those words aren't in the Constitution. Which is true. The words separation of church and state aren't in the Constitution, but they were obviously part of the intent of the founders, and they have been part of the foundation of our democracy for 200 years, more than 200 years. And the people who are arguing that we should do away with separation of the church and state don't realize that they will be the ones, if they're successful, they will be the ones that suffer in the end, because at some point, their religious beliefs will not be in the majority. And if we don't have separation of church and state, they will be penalized for their religious beliefs.
Right. I think it's pretty remarkable that that people would actually promote this. But, hopefully, it seems to be getting a pretty strong backlash. I don't think anybody here wants in America, or very, very few people in America want to live in a country that would reflect the kind of environment that the Taliban create, where religious authorities have the right to dictate whether you live or die. Or
how you live, or whether your lifestyle is the right one or the wrong one, or the appropriate one or the inappropriate one.
Right. That's totally un-American, and it's kind of surprising.
And we do have that issue on the ballot here. It's in Iowa right now with the campaign to try and unseat our independent judiciary and make it subject to basically to religious belief.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So I encourage you, if you're not familiar with this, to learn about the ballot question about whether or not to retain the judges. If the campaign to unseat the judges is based on a desire to politicize our judiciary and make it subject to a religious criteria.
Jeez.
Yeah. Scary stuff.
Yes, indeed.
So, but anyway, back to your book, Chronicle of Catastrophe. So you've been writing for quite a long time. Did you have writing experience before you started the newsletter?
I did not. I really started, actually, before I started the newsletter, I started the newsletter in 2002. I started writing in 1998 or 99. I just had some, my experience with running for public office had really was a tremendous learning experience for me. I really got acclimated to all the major issues in our political process and all the players and it just sparked something in me, and I really stayed interested in that and started formulating my political ideas and my political thinking. And so I started writing about this. I wrote a book, the first draft of a book in 1990 called The Politics of Unity. And this was it was really an early attempt at consolidating my political thoughts, and it was not published yet. And it really was not. I felt at that time that my political thinking was not mature enough to follow through with a publication. But I continued to write, and I wrote essays on different things and I occasionally would publish a letter to the editor or something. And I continued writing for a number of years, and then I just started to focus that in 2002 on the Risk and Opportunity newsletter, and then so that the process started a few years earlier.
Well, to me, essay writing, and particularly essays that have to do with economics and finance and politics, it's quite an incredible task. I've thought about delving into that somewhat myself, because I have a fairly broad background in business and finance and tax, but it's not easy to bring what you believe and know and what you've learned into a coherent essay. It's a real challenge, and I think you've done an excellent job at that, and particularly drawing on a number of resources, references to other writers, other thinkers, other economists and leaders in their field, experts, and the commentary on that. I'm impressed with what you've done.
Well, thank you. My process is probably unusual. You know, I'm not a first draft writer. Writing for me is more like sculpting. It really takes quite a long time for me to produce an end product, something that I feel comfortable about releasing onto the internet. And I start out with an idea that I think is pertinent, and then I just start writing, and I'll do my. You would never know that the final product was once that first draft. You know, they usually have very, very little resemblance to each other.
In the early drafts, are you sort of free writing, writing quickly?
I'll start the first draft. I try not to do any editing. I try to get down the basic framework of ideas that I'm looking to address in this newsletter, and then I'll let it sit for a few days, and then I'll come back to it and I'll go through it, and then things fill in. You know, I'll see a point that needs to be developed, and I'll develop that, And meanwhile, during the quarter, as I see articles that are of interest, then I'm collecting those. So I have resources to draw from, and quotes that I can draw from certain different publications, and so the process, it just goes on. It's it's become something that I'm familiar with now. And in the beginning, I didn't really understand how it worked for me because, I marvel at people like Glenn Greenwald, who can write what I do. It takes me weeks. He'll do that every day.
Wow.
It's a phenomenon. I don't know how he does it, but it doesn't work that way for me. I the whole picture comes together organically, and it fills out, and some points drop out, some things, some new things, as I see that there's a hole that needs to be filled, and a bridge to be that needs to be created, and I work on it over time, and then at a certain point I'll see that all the pieces are there, and then I start polishing, and I might have 6 or 8 or 10 drafts in the polishing stage.
And do you do this all on computer?
Yeah, I do. When I first started writing, I wasn't comfortable writing on the computer. I used to write on LegalPad and then put that onto the computer before, and then I would do editing on the computer. Nowadays, it's become second nature. I just start right out on the computer, and it's much more efficient.
And do you save drafts as you go? Do you save various versions, or do you?
I do. Mm-hmm. I will once there's enough substance in it that I might not save the very first draft, but I'll maybe the third. By the time I get to the third draft, I'll start saving those, and then. Each of those might have numerous iterations, but I do save them. And usually I find that every once in a while I'll go back and pull something from a previous draft that I had cut and reinsert it. But usually I end up not using that material, but I save it just in case I need some of that information. So yeah, it's easy to do, so it's helpful.
That is helpful. You're listening to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Michael Cudahy, author of Chronicle of Catastrophe, A Contemporaneous History of the Bush Years. So Michael, tell us a little bit about your publishing company.
Well, the publishing company is me. I did one of the things that one of the learning experiences that I went through in getting to the finished product was an investigation of trying to find a publisher, and I found that I, at least from my knowledge, I couldn't really actually access any of the publishers. I had to have an agent in order to get to a publisher. So I spent about 3 months, and there's a group in Chicago that will send you people that they think, agents that they think might be interested in your project. I think you pay them $300 or something, and they'll send you a short list, 7 or 8 people. So I went through all of that, and they want you to write a preface, and they want a chapter summary and all these things, and which most of that turned out to be useful and helpful for me and doing my table of contents and all of that. And I spent 3 months at it, and I got a lot of encouragement, but no takers. So mm-hmm. I decided to do my own, be my own publisher. And
because time was of the essence here.
Say again?
Because time was of the essence. It was important to you to publish before the election, I assume.
Yeah. So I pushed it, and I went, I had hoped to have it out in the spring. Actually, I had hoped to have it out before then, but the whole process was you know, it was all new to me. I had to learn at each step, you know, what to do, how to do, and it took, you know, it took a lot longer than I expected. And I started out with, when I finally got to the stage, I hired a fella to do the formatting and so on, and to help me with organization and figure out what are all the steps I needed to do. And when I got to printing stage, I started out with Lulu, and I decided that I didn't think that that wasn't going to work out, so I went to CreateSpace, and since then I've realized that that was a good decision.
And those are both website companies that help you self-publish, right?
On-demand self-publishing sites, yeah. And CreateSpace is owned by Amazon, and they've been a real pleasure to work with.
Well, that's good.
So
your book is available on Amazon. Is it available at anywhere here in Fairfield?
It's available at Revelations in Fairfield, and it's available at the Tattered Cover in Denver. And on Amazon.com, and you can also buy it off the website. I have a website, chronicleofcatastrophe.com, that gives a lot of information about the book and some reviews and my bio and so on.
And for anyone who wasn't listening at the beginning, your current newsletters are available at riskopportunity.com.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
So, yeah.
One last question, which is kind of a technical question. You know, you referred to some various articles and speeches and essays that you excerpted or even put in whole in the book. Did you have to get permissions to do that?
I did. Yes, I did, and that was one of the steps in my learning process is that about how to do the permissions, and I had to pay some of the people for their permission, and it was different with each one, and it was a whole process of finding them and arranging or their representatives and arranging for the permission.
Great. Well, Michael, we're out of time, believe it or not. It's amazing how quickly an hour can go when we have such a fascinating topic. And thank you so much for being on Writer's Voices with Chronicle of Catastrophe.
Well, thank you very much. It's really been a pleasure, and I hope to see you sometime in Fairfield.
I hope so, too. And this was Writer's Voice, and stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. Next week on Writer's Voices, we have Michael Fishman with Stumbling Into Infinity. Michael's another former Fairfielder, Stumbling Into Infinity, An Ordinary Man in the Sphere of Enlightenment. And after that, we have, the week after that, November 12th, we have Marcos Moulitsanis, founder of Daily Cause. And see you next week, and have a great weekend.
I'm Kilbourne and Chemaine, Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.